Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 29th, 2011. On today's show, investing is awfully confusing, so if you're hiring an expert to help out, make sure that expert has a duty to help you. We will outline broker versus financial advisor.
In many ways, they are very different, but they won't tell you that.
Of course, most of the time, if you want something done right, do it yourself. This week, we'll hear from the Jedi Master of Complaint Letters.
I guess I've been named Griper of the Year. Don't know if I can put it on my resume anytime soon.
That story and more coming up. But first, here's a candidate for Duh Headline of the Week. Inspector General says mortgage modification program a failure. Neil Barofsky said the government's efforts have been, quote, nothing short of abysmal, in part because regulators aren't doing anything to penalize the banks. Karen Andreen of La Mesa, California, wrote to us a few weeks ago with a mortgage modification horror story. Now, we've seen plenty of them over the last couple of years, but we were struck by her plea for help and by the fact that these homeowners seem to have done everything right, yet they're climbing the financial paperwork equivalent of Escher's never-ending staircase.
These are all the notice of intent to accelerate for foreclosures. As you can see,
contacted
we get
our representative.
So this is from his office thanking us for contacting him.
This is
and
the fax
I mailed in that they said that they didn't get. This
right
is or I saved a couple letters that I wrote to the President of the United States, hoping that someone in the White House might just listen.
Their story begins in April of 2007. Karen is 29 and was teaching second grade. Her husband, Kevin, teaches seventh grade. They have two kids. One is 3, one is 8 months. And they bought this condo conversion for $320,000. They had a 20% down payment and a 30-year fixed mortgage. The condo is less than 1,000 square feet. 2 years ago, Karen lost her job. So they thought it would be wise to refinance the house.
So I contacted the bank wondering what type of options we had. We knew that interest rates had dropped, so we thought maybe we could borrow some money and possibly refinance. And the bank informed us that was not an option because our property value had dropped so much.
How much?
At the time, I think it had dropped by about $40,000 or $50,000. I know right now it's dropped by 50%.
So what did you do?
Well, so the bank had first told us, you know, to apply for a loan modification. So we filled out the paperwork and we never heard back. And I was calling and calling. And then a couple months later, we received a letter of denial and I called to inquire. And then they said that we had been put in the wrong loan modification. And so then we reapplied and that was October of, well, it's been a little over a year, I guess. I can't quite remember.
09 then.
Yeah.
And who's your bank?
Bank of America. And so then we were put in this, the new loan modification. We were accepted into the program and they gave us our 3 trial payments. And they said at the end of the 3 months, then we would be able to get our loan modified.
Had you missed any payments at that
point? No, we have really good credit history. We've never been late on any type of payment ever. And we've been making the trial payments now for over a year.
And what is the trial payment? What is that based on? Did they bring down your interest rate? Did they?
Well, they haven't told us how they've assessed our trial payments.
They just gave you a number and said, pay this.
Right. No documents were signed. All we have is a sheet of paper basically saying, this is your trial payment. So every month we're paying $400 less. And so every month then we're assessed late fees and then they've sent people to knock on our door. So then we're assessed for the people knocking on our door. They've claimed that they're starting to foreclose on us. So we have a couple $1,000s in late fees.
And that's because you had a trial modification.
Correct.
Did anyone explain that to you?
No, I've called and I've asked about it. And they said that if we do get accepted to the loan modification program, that all those late fees will be rolled into our current mortgage and that the probability is high that our rate will actually go up instead of decrease.
So you could be in worse trouble because of the loan modification than you were before.
Yes, that is kind of what I've been led to believe when I've talked to them.
But they didn't tell you that before you got the modification.
No, they did not.
And for the intervening 14 months, Karen has been in a special kind of hell, bounced from one B of A department to another, phone tree after phone tree. So many redirected calls, in fact, that she keeps a daily log of transfers and misinformation.
September 17th, called 7:45, talked to Anne Marie, says Office of the President is working on the account, gave me the new phone number, transferred to the Office of the President, Executive Customer Relations, talked to Elizabeth, placed on hold while she reviews account, Appeal still valid. Received paperwork. Still in review. Assigned to advocate in the office of the president. Renee. Left message with Renee. Talked to Renee.
Her call logs also detail how long she's been on the phone.
Starting last spring, I started to keep track of how long I was on hold for, only because my phone battery started to die. It was an old phone and it would only last about 2 hours. I used our landline because I used our cell phone 1 month and racked up a huge bill. So I used our landline and my battery kept dying. So I actually had to get a new phone to make these phone calls.
She's been on the phone with the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, which helped direct her to the bank's advocacy department, but couldn't do much else. She called the Federal Hope for Homeowners program, which redirected her to the Federal Making Home Affordable program, to little avail. Lawyers have suggested the Andreens simply walk away, but after putting 20% down 4 years ago, they are not ready to do that. So they continued their appeals. They also continued making the modified payments and racking up fees, because here's the alternative.
If we make the actual payment, then we are removed from the program because then we have the money to pay.
What are you told about what your options are right at this moment?
The only options that we know of are to foreclose or stay here and ride it out.
That's because so many units in their condo complex are empty that banks will not provide financing to potential buyers. So selling their home, even in a short sale, is next to impossible. And if they try to ride it out?
I have no idea. I know every single month we get something saying if we don't make our full payment plus all the late fees that they will start foreclosure proceedings. Every month we get that. And every month they always say we have until about the 21st of the next month to become current or they'll foreclose.
So you just never know when somebody might come walking
in. Right. But every month the bank accepts our payments, our trial payments. And I supposedly they cannot foreclose if they accept a payment from you.
So you're watching for them to not accept a payment.
Yeah, on the first of every month I pay, and on the third I usually will go back to check to make sure that they accepted it.
Because if they don't...
Then we know to start packing our stuff.
So at any moment, you just expect someone to knock on the door and say you got to get out.
Yeah, because that happened to our neighbor last week, so pretty much.
How do you live like that?
Well, I went through and I repacked all of our baby's clothes. So that if we have 72 hours to vacate, all that stuff is already packed and ready to go.
In boxes.
In boxes. We keep an eye on what's for rent and how much. That way we'll kind of get an idea on where to go. However, they've dinged our credit because we're technically late $400 every month. So if you look at my credit rating, it used to be in the high 700s. And now it's in the low 600s. All because of our trial payments. I know a lot of people didn't put down any money. And I know for my husband and I, when we made our down payment, we knew that, or we thought that we had put down enough. And I mean, we live in our means. If we don't have cash, we don't buy something. We've never had any debt ever. I mean, we try to live very conservatively.
We called Bank of America to get their side of the Andreens story. Shortly thereafter, the family was told their case would get a so-called second look. B of A did not make anyone available for an interview with us, but they offered this statement from spokeswoman Jumana Bowens.
Back in March of 2010, we offered the Andreens a trial modification through Treasury's Home Affordable Modification Program. After that, we began the underwriting process for the modification and noticed some of the required documents were missing. So we reached out to them via mail and phone to inquire about those documents. Eventually, we had to decline them for the program due to those missing documents. In late July, the Andreens appealed the decision, and we determined that we could have done a better job in trying to contact them during that process. After that time, we began the review process of modification once again. Unfortunately, the Andreens did not meet the guideline requirements set out by the Treasury Department. We will continue to work with them to identify other modification solutions.
Bank of America spokeswoman Jumana Bowens. If you find yourself avoiding the mailbox this month, I'm pretty sure I can guess why. All that generosity you so proudly displayed over the holidays is coming back to haunt you in the form of credit card bills. We told you to set a budget for all those gifts, but if instead you are wondering how to pay down that debt, Chris Farrell has a primer.
Oh, I know. You set up a budget, but somehow between the online sales and the charitable contributions, you spent more than you wanted. Or maybe you didn't bother with a budget since money was tight, and you'd be careful no matter what, right? Wrong. The credit card bills coming due even have their own label, the holiday hangover. And this hangover lingers and lingers. Sure, credit card balances have fallen for 27 straight months as of November of last year. But don't get too excited. Consumer Reports says that as of October, almost 14 million Americans were still paying off credit card charges from their 2009 holiday purchases. Think about that. With 2010 winding down, people were still paying the bill on 2009 celebrations and gifts. What's more, numbers out from MasterCard suggest people went a little crazier this past year than they have in quite a while. Holiday sales jumped 5.5%, the best performance in half a decade. Now what? You know you need to clamp down on spending and free up some cash. But if you're like a lot of people, you owe more than what you racked up during the holidays. You were already carrying a balance on your credit cards, and I mean more than one. The loans all carry different interest rates, and the amount of each debt is different. What's the best way to tackle those debts? I like a math-savvy technique, but don't worry. It's very simple. Get all your credit card statements together. Put the debt with the highest interest rate at the top of the list. The lowest rate card is at the bottom. Here's the trick. Pay the minimum on all the credit cards, but the one with the highest rate. You're targeting all your extra savings at the high interest rate credit card. Attack it. Throw every penny you can scrounge up at it and target the money into that one card. When the highest rate debt is gone, go after the next highest credit card balance and so on down the list. You'll pay the least amount of interest this way and you'll end up without credit card debt. Not bad. And being debt-free? Well, it sure makes for a happy year.
Economics editor Chris Farrell, we want your advice for getting through the holiday debt hangover. So post your words of wisdom on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money. And it's time once again for your questions. And helping us out this week is our good friend Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch. Hello, Kathy.
Hey, Tess. How's it going?
I feel like we should talk about this next subject in 140 characters.
Can we tweet it, you mean?
Exactly. Something happened recently on Twitter that set the Twitterverse abuzz. And basically, the rapper 50 Cent talked up a penny stock and was basically able to make a fortune off of it. And people fell for it.
Well, I'm not going to say that he did something on purpose. He had about 30 million shares in the company, and he started tweeting about what a great buy it is, buy the stock now, you know, which is a typical penny stock pump and dump sort of scheme.
Right.
When we dug a little deeper, first of all, the company is losing money hand over fist. If you read their financial statements, they have to put out all these warnings to investors. Mm-hmm. And going through their warnings was like comical, right? You know, management has very limited experience. So, you know, translation, we don't know what we're doing. You know?
Nice. Well, speaking of comical, let's take a listen to what this company is.
Ouch! Stubbed your toe in the middle of the night? Stumbling around in the dark is dangerous. Now there's Brightfeet, the high-tech house shoes that light up your night.
High-tech house shoes that light up your night. This is the company.
Yeah, I actually have a photo on my blog because it cracked me up. It's like they have little tiny flashlights in the end of those slippers.
just so you don't bump your toe in the middle of the night.
I know. It just was so not fitty to me.
I'd like to see a photo of him with those things on.
Me too.
So the upshot here, I think, one, don't necessarily take your stock tips from someone in the music business, and don't take stock tips off of Twitter.
You know, the big thing is do your own research. This is your money, and if you don't want to lose it, you actually need to not invest on tips. Invest on solid information that you understand.
All right. I think that is an excellent point. And by the way, there are some great places to get financial information on Twitter. One of them is at Radio Tess. And the other one is?
CBS Money Watch, of course.
At CBS Money Watch.
Oh, sorry. Actually, it's at Kathy Kristoff, even.
There you go. All right. Let's hit the phones. Carolyn is with us from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
What do you do there in Tampa?
I am actually in the healthcare industry. I'm a physician's assistant.
So you're the person who helps me out when I'm in that little gown with the breeze blowing through?
We actually actually have shorts at my office, which is nice. We have short
pants.
Oh,
I want to go there.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
Why did anyone create those? Just to humiliate all of us?
They are absolutely horrible. We have crop tops that I prefer, although they're straight out of the 80s. They're pretty silly looking.
Something you would have seen on Jane Fonda?
Oh, definitely.
Well, what do you do on your off hours when you're not helping out patients?
Well, I actually do wildlife rehab, and I'm a volunteer zookeeper.
That is really cool. Have you always been interested in animals?
Always, ever since I was little.
So why did you go into healthcare instead of zoology then?
Because when the recession dipped, I was actually working in advertising. At that point, I realized I wanted to become a zookeeper, but the only jobs available were healthcare. But what I really want to do is I want to go back to school to become a zookeeper. That's why I'm calling you guys, because it's expensive.
What kind of schooling do you need for that? What kind of training?
Well, there's actually only two programs in the country that offer anything suitable for zookeeping training. One is at Moore Park in California. The other is at Santa Fe Community College in Gainesville. And that actually focuses on becoming a zookeeper and doing the day-to-day maintenance of the animals.
Now, did you talk to, you know, where you're volunteering? Have you talked to them at all about getting this zookeeping degree and how much it would help you?
Oh, definitely. The zookeeping degree is really the last piece that I need.
Great. So how much money are we talking to go back to school?
It's going to be $5,000 for the two-year program.
Right. But...
And is that something that you can handle with your savings, or are you looking at a loan?
Probably going to be looking at a loan, but I'm worried about taking on that much debt because I got through my bachelor's without having to do any loans. So
good,
I'd rather
you
not have to do loans now.
Well, you know, if you think you're going to be able to get through with just $5,000 in debt, and if it's federal student debt, that's probably not a payment that's going to be overwhelming to you. You can go on finaid.org. They actually have a student loan calculator. You can check out, you know, like what your monthly payments would be. And
okay,
if you qualify for federally subsidized student loans, they actually pay your interest while you're in college. And the interest rate is really low. So, I mean, I think that as long as you're going into a profession where you know that the income is going to be at least what you're accustomed to living on, then I think you're probably good.
What do you expect to make as a zookeeper?
To start off, $24,000 to $26,000.
And how much are you making now?
Almost 30.
So you're actually going to take a pay cut for a job where you have to go into debt to get it.
Exactly.
Okay. The only other thing I would really investigate is whether your employer will help subsidize your education. I know right now they're a volunteer employer, but talk to them. Check with also the for-profit sort of operations, things like SeaWorld, you know, to see if...
Scholarships.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Find out if there's any way you can defray that cost. They're also related to finaid.org, a for-profit website called FastWeb. There are all these specialized scholarships that you can try and qualify for. So that's also some place to look.
Well, thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate the advice.
All right. Thanks for the call, Carolyn. Good luck.
Thanks.
All right, next we've got Eric from Huntsville, Alabama. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
You work with wild animals?
Not quite. Just a dog. Just a dog.
So then what do you do there in Huntsville?
I'm currently a software application manager for a federal contracting company. Sit behind a computer and build software for different government entities. So that's the main job.
So you work with ones and zeros all day.
Yes, unfortunately.
Well, we were asking Carolyn what she does outside of her 9-to-5 workday. What do you do?
I own my own graphics and web company on the side. I started it up about 4 years ago.
Good for you.
And I do it for a lot of nonprofits and church organizations. This is a way to give back to others that don't necessarily have that skill set or the finances to actually pay for a lot of like heavy marketing. And I also serve on the board for Big Brothers Big Sisters and have a couple little brothers, and then also work with the Boys and Girls Club as well.
Fantastic.
You're a busy guy.
Yeah.
What do you teach the kids that you're working with through Boys and Girls Club?
That's the funny part about it. I actually try to teach them financial management and just how to manage your money, but then also, you know, make good life choices, life decisions when it comes to the area of finances.
So how do you get that message across to kids? Because we are always getting questions from listeners saying, how do I talk to my kids about money?
I usually engage them in what I do on an everyday basis, making decisions. I have about three or four guys that we go out consistently, and I create a budget, and I allot them $20 a month. And usually I tell them, you know, encourage them, use $5 a week. Don't spend all your money at one time, because whatever you do this time is going to affect what we can do the next two or three times until you get that next deposit at the beginning of the next month. They have to calculate how much they have. They keep all their receipts. They have to write down into the spreadsheet, you know, this is what I spent, this is what I spent it on. And I try to help them actually calculate the taxes and everything into it before they make the purchase. It's very fun.
Well, you know, this is so wonderful. Yeah, I mean, we have
just huge smiles on our face.
Yeah, because you know what? There is just not a better way to teach kids about money than to let them actually experience both the benefits and the detriments of how you do your own budget.
Yeah.
So what could you possibly need from us?
Yeah, really?
Sounds like you've got it all taken care of.
No. I went to school and I did get student loans. I paid off a significant amount of my student loans right out of college. Now I'm at a point where I'm trying to live, trying to get some form of a living, but at the same time really want to be debt free. And I'm stuck. I owe about $27,000, $28,000 on my student loans. And it's gotten to the point where the interest is not allowing me to kind of make any dents on that principal outside of, you know, maybe $100 every other month.
What's the interest rate you're paying right now?
It's right at 5.25%. And on the other one, I believe it's at 7%.
Well, that's not terrible.
It's not, but I've figured it out to be right at $4.25 a day. Hmm. Even though I don't eat out, I essentially am eating out at like McDonald's every day.
Right.
So what I try to do is I pay a little over the minimum balance required a month, but then I also save. And every 6 months, I'll actually take that lump sum savings and apply that to the principal. It's funny. It's like only then when I apply that extra savings is when I actually see the principal kind of jump down like I would expect it to do.
Are they applying your additional payments to future payments? Is that how they're doing it?
Yes. On the biggest loan, I'm actually paid out to 2013.
Oh, geez. Kathy's shaking her head.
Yeah. You know what? That's what you need to fix. That's wrong. They should be automatically applying the additional payment to principal. And because they're not doing that, they're accruing more interest on that loan, which is a really shady practice. But what you do is when you make your payment each month, if they require you to make it in two separate payments so that the separate one goes to principal, do that. Don't pay $1 extra that's not going to principal. Here's the other option. If they say you're paid up till 2013, say, great. All of my payments right now go
to principal.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I wondered about that.
And make sure you deal with this lender in writing, because if there's a problem, you want to be able to have something to show a small claims court or
paper trail.
Yeah, exactly.
Kathy, what about his strategy of saving up for 6 months and making a big one-time lump sum payment?
You know, that should not matter. You should be able to actually address your principal faster by making additional principal payments every month.
Right.
But that's because most, you know, legitimate lenders are applying any additional payment to your principal.
Yeah. Wow. So, Eric, it sounds like you have a little investigating to do.
Yeah, I don't mind. I want to see this go away, so I'm willing to do what it takes to get this thing corrected and fixed.
You got your marching orders.
Yes.
And then be sure to tell these kids that you work with what happened to you so that they can avoid having it happen to them.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I appreciate that. Definitely.
Well, and thanks so much for spreading the word about financial literacy to these kids. That is an invaluable service that you're doing to them, along with having fun with you.
Yeah, no kidding.
Thanks so much, Eric.
All right, thank you.
All right, and finally, we have G-Lo with us from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi there.
Hello.
Wonderful, interesting name.
Hey, thank you. It's a Japanese name. It means second son.
Second son. Oh, so you are the second son then?
Yes, I am.
Or your parents were just trying to confuse you, right?
That would be confusing.
So what do you do there in Nashua?
Well, I'm a traveling service technician. I live in Nashua, but I'm not really there in Nashua. So I travel about 75% of the time. And
what do you service?
Atomic emission spectrometers mainly.
Whoa.
I also do...
Both the intestine and our eyes are getting big. Whoa, that sounds complicated.
What is that?
Well, it's for condition monitoring. The application is used oil. So the principle is you run the oil through a bunch of equipment and you say, okay, well, we have spikes in iron and depletion in our additive packages, and it'll give you kind of an idea of what's happening to the motor.
So you're an engineer?
You know, they keep changing titles. I was a service engineer, now I'm a service tech. I bounce back and forth. I don't know what I am.
Well, you say you travel 75% of the time. Is that mostly in the U.S. or are you global?
I do global. Been to about 23 countries.
Wow.
And 48 states in the past 5 years now.
Do you get a chance to actually travel when you're traveling, or do you know every country by the oil rigs?
You have to make time for yourself. Like, I've, you know, taken a Mercedes on a German Autobahn going 140 miles an hour.
Oh, my gosh.
And I've eaten camel in Tunisia. If you're interested in the country, I would say make the time.
So I'm guessing that if you travel a lot for work, aren't most of your expenses paid?
That is correct. So with that, you know, I get to save a lot of money. This kind of leads up to my question. You know, I've been saving money heavily. I'm looking, you know, maybe in the next couple of years to buy a house. You know, I'm looking for something, you know, in around the $250,000 range, let's say. And I saved up about 80% of that. And, you know, I did a quick look online, and it seems like banks have a little resistance to giving such a small amount of a loan out.
I've never heard of that, Kathy.
Yeah, you know,
an 80% down payment is the bank is going to resist giving you a loan?
Yeah, my guess is when you go in person, the bankers are just going to get you coffee.
They're going to
give
you big,
like,
hugs.
Yeah, do you want a massage?
Where did you see that the lower the loan, the less a bank is going to be interested in you?
Yeah, I just did, you know, a quick Google search, and, you know, it was like, oh, banks are hesitant about giving out, you know, such small loans. They're not going to be making much money on the amount of money that they're putting out there.
No,
you
no,
know what? I'm gonna guess that what you found was a mortgage broker site. And mortgage brokers don't want to work with you if you have a small loan amount,
right?
Because they earn very little on the transaction. But banks directly want to work with you any day, any time. You know, they probably won't actually give you a massage, but they will be very, very happy to make you a loan when you have so much equity.
I see.
And, you know, you also can keep in mind that you don't necessarily have to put all of your equity into your home. You can invest in something else that might actually even return more than the 5% that you'd have to pay on the loan. So you have nothing but options because you have that kind of money.
I see.
So does that clear things up for you?
It does. That certainly helps a lot.
All right. Thanks for the call, G-Lo.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. If you've got a question, do let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That is 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, it's been fun as always. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much, Tess.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. You know what I forgot to ask, Kathy? What's in your wallet? But we've found plenty of other folks willing to fish them out and show us.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pockets.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
My name is Ben Willman, and I am standing at 5th Street and R Northwest in Washington, D.C. This wallet does have a story. I don't like the typical man wallet that gets like a big bagel in your pocket. I bought just the insert that goes in another wallet, and that's what I use, though it hasn't prevented it from growing. I have two tickets, stubs, to the Girl's Guide to the Second City. I also have two more tickets to a theater that I saw with my wife. I keep stubs because I imagine that I will do a scrapbook one day, but I don't think I've ever done a scrapbook. I have a Filene's receipt. I'm actually afraid to see what it is. Yeah, this was thinking I might return Christmas gifts, but I guess I can throw that away. I also have an email of a friend just randomly taped on the inside. My AAA card. Library card, stamps. I also have a picture of my wife and our cat. I had forgotten was tucked away in there. I think my father might have given me my first wallet. I do remember his wallet as a giant square growing thing that erupted receipts, and it's hard to believe it was ever flat. I think I remember being traumatized by the size of that wallet and telling myself I do not want that type of almost a loaf in your pocket.
Judith Ritter got that wallet open for us. Tell us what's in yours and post a photo if you'd like on our Facebook page or go to marketplace.org/money for more wallet tales. Nobody likes a snitch, especially one with 150 horses under the hood. And these days, it's entirely possible to drive a car that is telling on you. High-tech gadgets are hitting the road with us, aimed at changing our bad driving habits and maybe even saving us some money. Marketplace's Bob Moon got caught up in all this recently, so we asked him to take the concept for a test drive.
Have you noticed our cars are becoming nannies of the road? Take the new MyKey system that's now standard on most cars built by Ford. Maybe you own one of these new cars, or you've been in a rental car with the system activated. This car means business when it all but demands that you fasten your seatbelt.
If you're not buckled up, the radio won't play.
Andy Sarkeesian helped design Ford's unique MyKey system. It's being marketed, in this commercial for example, as a tool to keep your kids in line when they start driving the family car.
So how fast do you think this thing will go?
Like 130.
Which is the last thing a parent wants to hear. Once they hit MyKey's predetermined top speed, the limiter kicks in. And it's game over.
The car can be set to never exceed 80 miles per hour, and by popular demand, a limit of 65 is coming soon. Sarkeesian says this can also help the boss limit liability on company vehicles. My introduction to MyKey came in California's Mojave Desert when I accidentally got my Enterprise rent-a-car up to 80, and the speed limiter automatically engaged. Now, the contract says you're not supposed to drive in an unsafe manner, but will they start enforcing it this way? Sarkeesian says some rental companies have already signaled they're eager to impose these limits with a special request to Ford.
Asking us if there's tools that we can give them to make it easier to turn the system on more universally rather than vehicle by vehicle. That's a future development that we're working on.
We wondered if new technologies like this might help lower insurance costs, but we haven't found any companies offering discounts for owners who use the system. If you're willing to let some insurance companies look over your shoulder as a backseat nanny, though, you might save some bucks. Wisconsin-based American Family is offering a voluntary savings program that monitors the driver with a video camera. And Progressive Insurance has started offering up to 30% off for drivers who install a black box. It monitors such things as aggressive braking and how often a driver is on the road past midnight. Progressive's Richard Hutchinson says early testing shows some drivers won't make the grade in the company's snapshot program, but he promises they won't see rates go up.
We've done it as discount only, primarily to make people feel comfortable. That's not something that's going to be used against them. So worst case, you go through the effort and it doesn't work out. But, you know, for the majority of people, they do find that there is a discount in there for them.
Hutchinson says one in four customers are agreeing to use the black box, which regularly phones Progressive with their driving report card. But not everyone's happy with the idea. Richard Riggs is a Marketplace listener in New Jersey. He fears this will eventually end up being required.
You know the game. The game is if you participate, there'll be one price, and if you don't participate, it will be another price, and the another price will be higher even though you don't have any accidents.
If an 80-mile-per-hour speed limiter and monitoring of driving habits are such good ideas, might the government require them someday? At the Center for Auto Safety, Director Clarence Ditlow doubts that and says the marketplace will decide.
We see it much more likely to result in an insurance discount rather than a government mandate.
Then again, seatbelts used to be voluntary, too. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
All right, let me ask you a question. Broker or investment advisor? What's the difference? Well, if you know, then good for you. But it's a safe bet. Lots of you think the titles mean the same thing. The Securities and Exchange Commission is looking to remedy that, and it issued a report this week that could change the way many of us get investing advice. We thought this was a great subject for our new New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, to tackle. So she's here with us. And Heidi, there's a big difference here, isn't there? Advisor, broker?
Yes, in many ways they are very different, but they won't tell you that. So an investment advisor is somebody who you talk to about your financial plans and, most importantly, who has a duty to give you the best advice for you. That's called a fiduciary duty. A broker is a person who just sells you things, mm-hmm. sells you stocks or bonds or mutual funds. And brokers do not have to act in your best interest. They can act so that you give them the best commission possible.
Why haven't brokers had this responsibility to their clients versus to themselves?
Well, it doesn't benefit them. It benefits them to sell things, but who would impose it on them? Hmm. So far, people haven't thought about this issue. And now the SEC has looked at a landscape of the financial crisis when a lot of people ended up in investments they didn't want to be in right. and they didn't know the implications of it. And they're saying maybe one way to repair it is to impose this duty on brokers.
Okay, so what steps is the SEC looking to take then? Would they actually say that a broker has to have the same fiduciary duty as an investment advisor?
They would. The brokers would get a break, however. Investment advisors have a whole set of other regulations, things that they can say in public and so on that they have to meet with. Mm-hmm. Brokers wouldn't have to have that. They would just have to promise that they would be acting in your best interest.
Now, this was part of the Dodd-Frank Act, the Financial Reform Act that was passed last year. But from what I can tell, the act doesn't really say you have to do this, but it says address it somehow.
This is the flaw in most of Dodd-Frank. A lot of it has been left up in the air. It's particularly difficult with this issue because most investment advisors are very small and most brokers work with very big companies. So the question is, who will make sure that they do meet this duty if you do impose it? You have three options. You have the Securities and Exchange Commission, which governs out of Washington. You have the state regulators, who have a lot of time on their hands and recently grabbed a little bit more regulatory power over finance.
But the downside there is that then you get 50 different levels of regulation.
Exactly. You could also have what Wall Street calls an SRO, a self-regulatory organization, where the brokers would represent themselves in an organization that would then allow you as a customer to arbitrate any of your claims against them. But the question is, would they do as good a job?
And given that they haven't regulated themselves up till now, why would they start?
That's exactly the question.
So unless and until there is a decision on all of this, what's the advice to people who, again, perhaps didn't realize that there was a difference between their broker and their financial advisor?
Well, the most important piece of advice is to ask the question. You have to ask what their conflicts of interest are, how they get paid, and whether the advice that they're giving you is done with a fiduciary duty.
It's just hard to imagine a broker is going to say, no, actually, I have no fiduciary responsibility to you.
They'll probably avoid it. But they still have to answer the question.
All right. Thanks, Heidi.
Thank you, Tess.
This week, Spain's government raised the retirement age from 65 to 67. It's part of an effort to get that country back on solid financial footing in the wake of enormous budget deficits. A couple of months ago, the U.S. Deficit Commission recommended raising our retirement age to 68 for similar budget reasons. Germany has already done it, raised their age by 2 years to 67. But companies and employees there are finding that working later in life has some unexpected consequences. Caitlin Carroll reports from Berlin.
Most mornings, it's still dark outside when workers drive through Berlin to pick up the city's trash. It's a tough job. They have to push heavy bins from apartment buildings and homes out to the garbage trucks. Every stop, workers jump off the truck and then jump back on again. The job is especially rough on aging joints.
If you're 55 and already a bit tired and things begin to ache, your back and everything, if you're 30 years in waste collection, you're not really in very good shape anymore.
Andreas Schultz-Fleischmann is on the board of the waste management company BSR. About 5 years ago, the firm analyzed its workforce and found that the average age of its 5,000 employees was 46 and rising.
Most of the people are between 40 and 55, and there are almost no people below 30 and no people above 60.
It's a similar case for many companies in Western Europe. Birth rates have fallen. There aren't enough young people to replace those who retire in specialized fields like engineering. That's why the German government is raising the retirement age. but adding a few years to a workforce can change the dynamic of a company. Older workers often have different priorities than their younger colleagues. They need more training to keep up with the latest technology. A lot of them want flexible schedules so they can take time off for health issues or just relaxation. Jürgen Deller teaches human resource management at Germany's Leuphana University.
They have no experience how you manage these people. They have never supported them, usually, health-wise, for instance.
HR managers sometimes meet resistance from higher up when they push for long-term plans to deal with their aging workforces. A recent study showed around 80% of executives don't see demographic issues as a big deal. But Deller says they can't ignore the topic much longer.
In 5 years' time, we will have a shortage of more than 3 million qualified employees in Germany. And that's a big number for a country of 80 million.
Some businesses now provide better working conditions for their older employees. They realize it often costs more to find and train a new employee than to hold on to the ones they have. Auto companies like Audi and BMW are gaining ground on competitors with their innovative programs. BMW made about 70 small changes. Workers get special shoes, places to sit near the assembly line, and computer screens with bigger type. Productivity has gone up by 7%. BSR, the waste management company in Berlin, is trying some changes of its own. Klaus-Dieter Kletter is a 62-year-old employee. He started at BSR 35 years ago. Kletter can no longer handle the daily grind of garbage pickup, so he's participating in a new project. It's called Lid to Lid. Older workers install new lids on broken trash cans. The work is less physically grueling. He's able to work with friends he's known for decades. And because of this, Kletter feels good about staying around.
Ich muss sagen, ich denke noch gar nicht an eine Pension.
Well, actually, I'm not thinking about retirement at the moment. I mean, there's still 3 years to go, and I will work until I will finish and go into retirement, and then we'll see what happens.
Kletter's plans may be up in the air, but companies need to start thinking about what comes next. About a fifth of the German population will turn 65 in the next decade. That's a lot of jobs to fill. In Berlin, I'm Caitlin Carroll. For Marketplace Money.
If you've got a beef about bad customer service, don't yell, don't get angry, get even. I'm just kidding. But you might try a good old-fashioned letter and then submit it to a complaint letter writing contest on Slate.com. About 150 people did just that after columnist Timothy Noah invited them to submit their best efforts. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with what I think is the slow death of customer service. Why is it so hard to get help these days?
I don't believe that customer service is actually dead. I think it's just gone into hiding. It's hiding behind a big old call center in Manila. And eventually somebody comes onto the line and tells you that they can't help you. And the next step is to write an irate letter to the CEO of the company or to the Better Business Bureau.
Is the Better Business Bureau actually do anything anymore? Wouldn't it be more effective to just tweet something?
Tweeting might work as well. The Better Business Bureau ranks companies, and that whole process is somewhat corrupt. It's a little bit of a protection racket. You have to be a member to really usually get a good rating. But in fielding complaints, the Better Business Bureau is still a perfectly good place to squawk about a company.
But I wonder if in some way many of us have just given up on even trying to get good customer service.
There is a lot of resignation out there, and I confess that I am one of these resigned people.
So am I.
But there is another breed, people who take it to the next level and they write a letter. So then the question becomes, is your letter the kind of letter that's really going to get results?
Well, let's talk about your complaint letter contest. I think I remember when you launched it, you said, let the kvetching begin. So what kind of response did you get?
We got a big response. We got about 150 letters, but most of the letters I felt were really not up to snuff. I think that's because when you announce that you're having a contest inviting readers to submit angry customer letters, you attract a certain crowd. And I felt slightly annoyed because I had said in my contest instructions, don't get angry, and the other was be succinct. And I have to say that even most of the winners of my contest ignored those two pieces of advice.
All right, so you had 9 finalists, and then you asked your readers to cast their votes, right?
Yes, we had an interactive poll, and our ultimate winner was a very popular choice from the get-go.
Well, let's talk to him. Keith Bertrand is on the line with us. Hi, Keith.
Hi.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I guess I've been named Griper of the Year. I don't know if I can put it on my resume anytime soon, but it's quite an honor, nevertheless.
Well, tell us a little bit about what your complaint was.
My wife and I had identical wedding bands, and there are two-tone things that have an inner band that's gold and an outer one that's platinum. And my wife's band, the outer platinum ring, was becoming loose and it was in danger of falling off. So we went to the company to try to get that fixed. Initially, we didn't have good results. They felt that somehow we had altered this ring, and we certainly hadn't. So then in desperation, I wrote a letter and I just faxed it in.
And who did you hear from?
I got a call back from the president of the company, and he was very gracious. It turned out it's a family-owned company, and he was happy to uphold the values of the company, and he replaced the ring free of charge.
Well, read us the part of the letter that that you think won them over.
When we look at these rings, we want to be reminded of what we have always been reminded of and what we were meant to be always reminded of, our commitment to each other. We don't want to look at Jill's ring and think of it as just another piece of defective merchandise that we had to pay for twice because the company that made it was unwilling to stand behind it.
Timothy, you were partially a judge. At least you picked the 9 finalists here. Why was this one a standout for you?
I was intrigued by the fact that it was such a good letter, even though it violated one of my rules. I said, don't say in your letter how this problem makes you feel. Just explain the problem. And here, this letter obviously did the precise opposite. And, you know, it was very moving.
One thing that I did in my letter was I quoted back the mission statement of the company. And I think that's, in the end, what the company president saw.
Well, congratulations. And
thank you.
Particularly congratulations on getting a response, but also on becoming the Griper of the Year.
Griper of the Year, yeah. I guess my next career move is probably into reality television with a title like that.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, I have to say, I guess from the company perspective, you have to recognize that if someone is going to take the time to write a letter like this, that they're probably pretty loyal to your brand, and that's something you need to pay attention to.
That's a nice way of putting it. A not nice way of putting it is if somebody's going to take the trouble to write a letter, then they really know how to make things happen. So you want to pay a little bit more attention to their complaints.
Thanks so much, Tim.
Thanks for having me.
Timothy Noah pens the customer column at Slate.com, where he is also a senior writer. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, we've got robots that vacuum, phones that do everything except wash dishes. What's next?
There are potentials for us creating really, really smart systems that are smarter about your money than you are.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. York. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering long-term investment strategies built on experience, discipline, and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. This is Putnam Today.
American Public Media.